I've never felt more pain and pained to be a Jew, but never more privileged and never more proud. Yom HaAtzmaut is the pride and the privilege now for 78 years of having an independent Jewish state for the first time, as we know, in 1900 years. Yom HaZikaron is the pain, and it's an excruciating pain. He took that very, very critical and fateful decision to leave the safety of his tank position as the last line of defense and go straight towards the second wave of terrorists and knock over as many and put his head out the tank and shoot. That his whole, as Matan said, told us, they all followed him. They all had absolute faith in him. It was a tank which together made a decision that they need to do whatever they can to defend the Jewish people.
Hey, Lav, how are you doing?
Okay. How are you?
Thank God. I think it's always a powerful time in Israel on the eve of Memorial Day, Yom HaZikaron, and then Yom HaAtzmaut, that transformation from the day of mourning and remembrance to the day of celebration of our independence. And we have a truly moving and powerful conversation with Rabbi Doron Peretz on this week's podcast. But before we get to the interview, we're in a week of ceasefires, ending ceasefires, different arenas. What do you think? What's your take?
I guess we should start with Lebanon because that's newer. On Thursday, President Trump announced the ceasefire in Lebanon, and it doesn't look that much like a ceasefire, right? Israel reserves the right for self-defense. Hezbollah keeps doing things that Israel has to stop in its self-defense. And the U.S. doesn't seem to have specific complaints about Israel doing these things. But a day after the ceasefire was announced, President Trump came out with this very strange sort of post on Truth Social where he said that Israel is prohibited, in all capital letters, from bombing Hezbollah, and enough is enough. And again, this was almost a full day after Israel agreed to a ceasefire. I'm not certain if there was any like military action in Lebanon or not within the framework of the ceasefire, but... And ceasefire is probably not even the right word for what it is. It's like a break, right? It's supposed to be a 10-day break to show, I guess, goodwill in the negotiations with the government of Lebanon, which, of course, is not the same as Hezbollah.
Or with the government of Iran.
Well, right. So that's the interesting point, right? Because in theory, there's two separate things going on, right? The government of Lebanon says Iran doesn't represent them and doesn't have a right to negotiate for them, and that they're conducting their own negotiation with Israel. Israel would for sure prefer that, right? But on the other hand, Iran says, oh, well, they're not going to continue the ceasefire, which is supposed to end on Tuesday, but there's negotiations that are supposed, that may or may not be happening in Pakistan between now and Tuesday night. So who knows what it'll be. So Iran says they won't have a ceasefire unless the ceasefire includes Hezbollah. And Lebanon and Israel want that negotiation to be a separate thing because the government of Lebanon is not an Iranian proxy the way Hezbollah is. So it's it'll be interesting to see how this works out going forward.
It's important to understand also what the current situation is, you know, whether Trump, the United States, did prohibit Israel from, say, further deepening the military entrenchment. The current situation is that Israel is essentially holding a buffer zone in across southern Lebanon from the Mediterranean all the way to Syria, to the Hermon. There's three threats from Hezbollah. There's the threat of infiltration, Hezbollah fires crossing the border. There's the threat of what's called direct fire threat, of Hezbollah firing anti-tank missiles, RPGs, other kinds of shoulder-fired rockets and other kinds of ammunition directly at Israeli towns and villages and civilians. And then there's the sort of the longer distance threat of the rockets that are fired that go up and then go down, right? Or are they going directly? Now, as long as Israel is in this buffer zone and it's allowed to be, or it's agreed that it's in this buffer zone, at least vis-a-vis the United States, during the ceasefire, then the infiltration threat and the direct fire threat are essentially not threats to the people of northern Israel.
Right. So the buffer zone is, I believe it's 5 kilometers from Israel's northern border, because that's right. The range of the anti-tank missiles.
Exactly. And then, and some places are sort of in the high ridges so that they can't, so that Hezbollah can't stand there and fire into northern Israel. Now, people have been comparing this to the buffer zone that Israel held from 1982 to 2000, which didn't end well and ended in a hasty Israeli retreat. I do think it's important to understand that the situations are not necessarily comparable, both in terms of the way Israel is deployed, both in terms of whether or not there's a civilian, Lebanese civilian population in the area. There's many fewer Lebanese civilians currently there. And also just to be frank, the way, the abilities, the capabilities that Israel has, whether from the air, whether in intelligence, whether in other means, to assure that Hezbollah can attack its forces or can attack Israel without the need for sort of massive amounts of static forces in southern Lebanon. So the fact that it perhaps didn't end well or didn't work as well in from 1982 to 2000 doesn't mean it won't work well now, at least until the Lebanese government is able to get its act together and actually deploy and actually disarm Hezbollah, which they haven't been able to do yet.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if we went around and we polled Israelis, and I haven't seen an actual poll of this, so I don't know with certainty, they probably wouldn't want large numbers of soldiers holding a buffer zone in Lebanon long term. Right? Which, as you said, we had that for 18 years and we left in 2000. But Israelis also do not, and this we actually have polling data, overwhelmingly didn't want a ceasefire in Lebanon. We don't have public opinion polling after the ceasefire already happened, but we have from literally the day before when there were already rumors of a ceasefire, and Israelis did not want a ceasefire. Because they feel that the job is not done. They feel that their, you know, friends and loved ones who live in Israel's north are still under threat from Hezbollah. I think that they're right, but the question is, how can we hold both things, right? You want to have your cake and eat it too. You don't want to have like a huge military occupation, not my favorite word, but that's really what it is, of the buffer zone long term, but on the other hand, you don't want Hezbollah in there. My concern is that the government of Lebanon and the Lebanese armed forces, they're essentially a failed state, and I don't know what their capabilities are here. I think there's a greater will to try to stop Hezbollah than there was even 4 months ago, 6 months ago, but whether that'll be translated into results is unclear.
I think what we have to hope is that on the one hand, Israel is able to degrade and, you know, destroy more and more of Hezbollah's fighters and commanders and capabilities. And that this time, Iran is not, if the economic sanctions stay on and or if there's a change in the government sometime, that Iran is not able to rebuild Hezbollah's capabilities, certainly not nearly as quickly, so that the damage that Israel creates to Hezbollah's strength and power remains. And if that, you know, if the Hezbollah's capabilities are further and further degraded, we may get to a point where the Lebanese armed forces, first of all, are pressured enough to actually take action against Hezbollah, and because Hezbollah is weakened to such a degree that they're actually able to operate effectively against Hezbollah. I think that would be probably the best case scenario that we can hope for. I did want to just also say something about, there was this, these terrible images of Israeli soldiers desecrating a statue of Jesus in a Christian village in Lebanon. It was a terrible incident which never should have happened. And it's good the army said that these soldiers are going to be punished, and hopefully they will be. I can say that as somebody who served in Lebanon and who also was stationed on the Lebanese border, not too far from various Christian communities and towns in southern Lebanon, we actually avoided to the absolute degree possible going into these towns, attacking towns, unless we knew for sure that Hezbollah was present in them, that there was a Hezbollah infrastructure, precisely because Israel didn't want to harm in any way, against, unless absolutely necessary, any of these Christian communities. So overall, I can say, my personal experience, the policy was to avoid touching Christian communities in southern Lebanon as much as possible.
There's this unfortunate, like, very, very small, but very, very destructive and damaging group of Israelis who seem to think that they have something to gain from public disrespect for Christians and Christianity. Let's put it that way. You know, like you and I are not Christian. We don't believe what Christians believe. But like, I would never think to destroy a statue of Jesus and that was like in somebody else's property, or to spit on anyone, let alone a priest walking by me in the streets of Jerusalem. And I can't even get into the heads of people who do those things. But it just ends up being incredibly damaging for Israel. And like, we know these incidents are like single incidents that happen very rarely. And yet the things that get on the internet, they sort of live there forever. And it's just so disturbing and so unfortunate that Israel just has to keep dealing with these things over and over, because they create these like internet scandal moments.
Absolutely. I agree wholeheartedly. And I would hope that the IDF, in the case of the soldiers, the Israeli police, in the case of those spitting on the priests, I mean, use a heavy hand to stop these kinds of attacks.
You know, you and I didn't grow up in Israel. We talk a little bit more about that topic later with our guests. So we, you know, I think have like a greater instinct for tolerance for people who are different from us. And I think it's sometimes hard when people live in Israel and they're used to being the Jewish majority and they're just used to being the majority. I think that I'm not saying that most Israelis don't respect minorities or people different from themselves, but I think that there needs to be a more active education towards tolerance, because people in their everyday lives have less of an interaction and less friction with people who are different from themselves. And I think that maybe that's part of the problem, honestly, which is like most Israelis, especially young people, you know, probably don't know a lot about Christians other than like really bad things that happened in history. And they probably almost never encounter a Christian unless, you know, they're on vacation, but they don't really like know anything about the people who are on the street in whatever country they're visiting in Europe. And so maybe education is part of the answer here.
The other ceasefire that is supposed to be up this week is the ceasefire with Iran. And there are, you know, all these different reports. They're going to be negotiations. They're not going to be negotiations. The Iranians are going to show up. The Iranians are not going to show up. Here, it seems like, in my view, the outcome whereby the United States agreed to essentially remove economic sanctions on Iran and, you know, allow this massive inflow of money to the Iranian economy would be very problematic, because the regime is still in place, you know, whether it's the IRGC is more powerful or whether, you know, the certain political figures are more powerful, but overall the regime is still in place. And to the extent that they're able to rebuild their economic capabilities and be able to rebuild not only their military capabilities, but also to reassert their control. And a better outcome would be some kind of, you know, more narrow agreement where the economic sanctions remain in place, and that preserves the chance that the people once again take to the streets. I think there's still a lot more organizing that needs to be done.
Yeah.
I have to say, you know, certainly, you know, the Jewish people or Israelis have been known to be divided. Many conversations with many different figures in the Iranian diaspora, there seems to be quite a lot of divisions among the Iranian diaspora, various organizations, like supporting this figure, supporting that figure, supporting this parliament or this Congress. It seems to me there needs to be also greater unity in order to sort of create that alternative leadership. But certainly we wouldn't want the regime to be able to reassert itself and restabilize itself in Iran.
You know, I don't know what to think about this outline that was published, because on the one hand, it was reported by a journalist who I respect a lot, Amit Segal. But on the other hand, analysts who I respect a lot and Washington-based people I respect a lot say that they just don't think that that's something that President Trump would ever accept. And I do think that President Trump understands the values of sanctions. I mean, he's certainly the guy who put the maximum pressure sanctions on Iran in his first term. So I start out with hoping that that's not the real plan, because the sanctions are very important. I mean, they're important to stop Iran from rebuilding, right, and reversing a lot of the progress made during this war. And also, yes, because hopefully it will hasten the regime's demise. And frankly, Israel won't know a moment's peace as long as the, you know, radical mullahs rule Iran and sponsor proxies that attack Israel day in and day out. You know, Israel especially needs this regime to go. But I think that for the entire West, I mean, they're a threat, and they've indicated that. And, you know, in language and in deed, again and again and again over the past 47 years, the fact that most Western countries are living in denial doesn't change that fact. Well, this is the Misgav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons, the podcast for anyone who wants to truly understand what's happening in the Middle East beyond headlines and spin. I'm your co-host, Lahav Harkov, a Misgav Institute senior fellow and senior political correspondent for Jewish Insider.
And I'm Asher Fredman, executive director of the Misgav Institute and a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation. The Misgav Institute is Israel's leading national security policy center dedicated to strengthening Israel's security, its regional cooperation, and its international alliances. And each week here on Mideast Horizons, we cut through the noise to bring you fresh insights and perspectives and really important, powerful interviews relating to the most important stories, the most important issues on the national security agenda.
Please subscribe and follow wherever you listen to podcasts to keep up to date and ahead of the curve on everything connected to the Middle East. You can reach out to us with comments and suggestions at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com.
And we read all of your comments and your suggestions, so please keep them coming.
This week, we have Rabbi Doron Peretz as our guest. We invited him because this podcast will be coming out on Yom HaZikaron, which is Israel's Memorial Day for fallen soldiers and victims of terror. We interviewed Rabbi Peretz in part because he lost his son, Captain Daniel Peretz, on October 7th, but he found out much later, as he will tell us. But Rabbi Peretz is also president of the World Zionist Organization and the head of... He was head of World Mizrahi, which is sort of the leading religious Zionist organization, global religious Zionist organization. He previously was a rabbi in the South African Jewish community for 15 years. My husband's family knows him well. They always said he was the fun young rabbi of the community. Anyway, to his bio, to the rest of his bio, Rabbi Peretz authored two books, Leading the Way, a collection of writings on some of life's most important issues, and recently The Jewish State, From Opposition to Opportunity, a manifesto on Zionism and Jewish statehood. So we're very excited to have Rabbi Peretz on here to speak to us during this really important week on the Israeli and the Jewish calendar.
Rabbi Doron Peretz, thank you for joining the Mideast Horizons podcast. It's really an honor to have you.
Thank you, Asher. Thank you, Lahav. Honor to be with you. Thank you.
And we're speaking on the eve of Israel's Memorial Day, which is followed right afterwards by Israel's Independence Day. You are president of World Mizrahi, president of the World Zionist Organization, but also on a very, very personal level, you're also the father of Captain Daniel Peretz of blessed memory, who fell on October 7th, 2023. How does you feel about the juxtaposition of these 2 days, Memorial Day and Independence Day?
Although, firstly, it's an honor to be with both of you, and thank you for the opportunity to share some words. Although on a personal level, it's so difficult to hold together both the pain, what I call the pain and the privilege. I think it actually is, on a deeper level, the story of life, and especially of Jewish life. You know, I often say one of the things I've said maybe more than anything in the last 920 days or so since that day, on October 7th, Simchat Torah, is that I've never felt more pain and pained to be a Jew, but never more privileged and never more proud. Yom HaAtzmaut is the pride and the privilege now for 78 years of having an independent Jewish state for the first time, as we know, in 1900 years. Yom HaZikaron is the pain, and it's an excruciating pain. But where I've got a lot of strength is actually from the story of the Jewish people and how our sages tell us the story in the Haggadah. At the end of the day, the Haggadah is the way the sages have told us at the dawn of our people on Pesach, how are we supposed to communicate with our children what it means to be a Jew? And I've become much more sensitized to it since October 7th. When I read the Haggadah now, I actually take the word seriously. Ha lach ma'anya. This is the bread of affliction. Before we're going to tell you about the coming out of Egypt and the miracles and the good news and the Pesach and God passing over our homes, well, he didn't pass over our homes for a long time. And so many Jews died. And so many Jews, young Jewish children were thrown into the Nile. And our sages were sensitive to the pain of servitude, that they said, if you want to tell your children the story of Jewish history, of Jewish redemption, of Jewish liberation, the first thing you tell them is how painful it was. Ha lach ma'anya, this is the bread of affliction. Yes, this is going to be the bread of redemption. But before it became the bread of redemption, it was the bread of those chatufim, of those us afflicted Jews in servitude and slavery, this half dry piece of pita that we ate day in and day out. This is the bread of affliction because the Torah calls it in Parashat Ra'eh, Lechem Oni, the bread of affliction. And by the way, this is why it's the only festival that, although in Jewish law you're supposed to have, which we have on all the other Chagim, the festivals, and on Shabbat we have Lechem Mishnah, we have two complete Chalot. The only time we don't have a complete Challah is on Pesach, where we break the middle Matzah. We keep the larger broken part for the Afikomen, and the middle broken part is what we read the Haggadah on. We read the Haggadah, according to our sages, on Lechem Chatzuya, on broken bread, because that is the story of our people. It's a story with so much brokenness. It's a story which our sages say that the plot of the Haggadah is, our sages say it in four words in the Mishnah, Matril Begnut, Umasayim Beshvach. You have to tell the story first of the pain. Avadim Hayinu LeParo B'Mitzrayim. If you begin the story that we came out of Egypt and was all hunky dory, and all these miracles were done for us, and you don't tell the story first and foremost, Avadim Hayinu LeParo B'Mitzrayim. There was Maror, there was Lechem Oni. If you don't tell that story, then you've only told half the story. So for me, the pain is unfortunately forever part of the story. One thing I've learned is that the pain doesn't go away. And the truth is, I don't really want it to totally go away. I don't want to get over the loss of my son. I don't want to wake up in the morning and say the loss of our son, Daniel, who was in our life for 22 and a half years, it's okay, we're okay, as if it didn't happen, or we've totally healed. How do you heal from the loss of a son? I don't know if you can heal from that. And I don't want to heal from it. But you know what I've learned? It's what our sages have taught us in the Haggadah. You don't have to ignore and get over the pain. You have to bring the pain with you. What I've learned is when you say to somebody, get on with it, it's actually not get on with it. It's get on with it. Bring it with you. You know, I say to people, sometimes you say, you know, get on with it, enough. Meaning that the getting on with it is actually undermining the pain. But also losing yourself in the pain is not the Jewish story. I think the modern Jewish story is exactly the story of ancient, the Jewish people, that we go from Yom HaZikaron, we remember the enormous pain, and it's actually very prescient that we begin it a week earlier with Yom HaShoah. We remember the pain of exile. We remember the pain of Yom HaShoah. We remember the pain that we constantly pay for there to be a state, and we bring that pain with us. It is part of our story, but it's not the story. We transition to the story itself. It's a story of hope. It's a story of redemption. It's a story of salvation. So that is the story of the Jewish people. It's an amazing story, but it doesn't mean that an amazing story of hope is not laced with pain. I'll just tell you one final thought before we move on to the next question. And it's, you know, this seems quite theoretical. I lived it in the first 10 days when our son Daniel had been in his heroic defense of Nachal Oz. He was missing along with two other members of his team, Itai Chen and Matan Angres, who thankfully came back alive. Three of them were missing. One died and was, you know, found in the tank. His name is Tomer Leibovitz, Zichrono Livracha. And I remember when they came to us and to tell us on the Thursday at 7:30 in the morning, the dreaded knock on the door, that the first Thursday that our son Daniel was missing. Firstly, I couldn't get over, how does somebody go missing? I said, how does somebody evaporate? What, you come to tell me 6 days later that the only thing you confirm is you don't know where he is? He was missing. But we had a big decision to make. Asher and Lahav, we had a wedding of our oldest son, Yonatan, who was supposed to be on the 17th of October, who himself was an officer in the army and injured in the battles. And we decided to go ahead with the wedding. We cancelled the wedding hall. We did a small wedding on the 17th of October. And I didn't think it was possible, but somehow we managed to get through it. And I remember reflecting on the wedding, saying a friend of mine said that this was the most, her words were, she said, Rob Perez, this was the most, the saddest, happiest, most inspiring wedding I've ever been at. For us, it was a happy wedding of bringing one son down the aisle while having moments of incredible worry, concern, and pain for not knowing about Daniel. But I remember the two words that were going on in my head is charada and chedva, trembling for the fate of Daniel and elation for the simcha of Yonatan. And I realized thereafter that as crazy as it seems experientially, a human being, and certainly a Jew, which has experienced so much of this, is capable of somehow holding together excruciating pain and loss and yearning with incredible exhilaration and happiness. If I would have heard myself speak like this 2.5 years ago, I wouldn't have known what I'm talking about. It would have sounded very theoretical, but not practical. I can't explain it to you, but somehow I think the founders of our state have got it right. Our sages have, of course, got it right in experiencing that, as crazy as it seems, they do somehow go together. They're part of the same story.
So some of our listeners may not know, for the first few months of the war, there was a chance that Daniel was alive, and he was considered, I mean, the whole time was considered one of the chatufim, one of the hostages. And then a few months into the war, it was January or February, you found out that he had been, in fact, killed in action and that Hamas was holding his body. I remember I spoke to you a few days before we found out, published an interview with you, and then within a day or two, we found out, and it was just terrible, terrible news. But you were also someone who was part of the Bring Them Home campaign, but also in a way, I would say, above the arguments, and you managed to stay sort of above the politics and some of the divisive rhetoric that ended up coming out about different groups of families and what they thought the government should or shouldn't be doing. I was wondering if you could take us to that time and to the difficulties, I think, in taking such a personal tragedy and having to handle it as a somewhat of a public person. You were more of a public person to begin with. Most of these people were suddenly thrust into that role.
Lava, I do remember that interview. You know, I've tried to handle this in the most authentic way that I can. I've tried to handle this in what feels like right to me. I wouldn't feel comfortable revealing personal things which don't belong in the public area, but at the same time, I feel comfortable to process the personal challenge in a way that it feels to me authentic and appropriate in terms of my public role. And I've somehow seen it together. I haven't sort of, you know, felt, oh, this is how I'm dealing with it privately and have to put in a face publicly. I've sort of tried to process it in a way that felt authentic to me. Indeed, as you've said, Lahav, well, we in the beginning, you know, it's still hard for my wife and I to believe that for 2 years our son was a hostage. Indeed, for 163 days, and from the 7th of October, for 2 weeks he was missing. We were told after 2 weeks that he was confirmed to have been taken hostage. We hoped and prayed for 163 days. It was actually on the 17th of March that we were told, after 163 days, that in fact, based on evidence that they'd found on certain terrorists and other video evidence, that he in fact had been killed, unfortunately, on October 7th. And that was obviously very, very, very painful, painful day. And then we had this dilemma of, do we do a funeral? Because the army, we knew that he had been injured because the army had told us that they had found a army uniform, a chutzama, they bet his sort of his work army clothes, the shirt with his rank on it and with blood. And the blood had been tested with DNA and we knew that it was his blood. So we knew that Daniel had been injured. We hoped and pray there was a light injury. The sort of the blood was on his arm and the side of his body. So we knew he'd been injured. There was also blood found in the tank. So that we knew, but we hoped and prayed that he was alive because there was no evidence to the contrary. So when we got that news on March 17th, it was absolutely devastating. We then had to obviously decide, what do we do? The army and the chief rabbinist of the army strongly advised us to do a funeral. As we know, according to Jewish law, if you have blood to bury in here, we had significant blood in the uniform, you should bury it. The debate we had was, should we do a military funeral? The reason we decided to go ahead with the chief rabbinist of the army and the heads of the army was because, you know, there was no guarantee we were going to get Daniel's body back. Who knows? You know, the Golden family had waited until recently for 11 and a half years. So are we going to protest and not do a funeral? It just felt like the right thing to honor him. Thankfully, in inverted commas, we actually had something to bury. Their families just didn't have anything to bury. And we buried him. We buried his uniform. And I have to say, the next year and a half was so challenging because we knew that he was dead and he had passed away. And I wanted to say, thankfully, we had no doubts that he had passed away. There's some families who still had an element of doubt, which is so hard to live with an element of doubt. We didn't have an element of doubt because of how, you know, when we looked into it. But still, knowing that we had to bring him back was so challenging. But I must say, you know, he came back on Simchat Torah, the last Simchat Torah, exactly 2 years to the day that he was killed and taken hostage, which in and of itself is you know, miraculous. His member of his tank, Matan Angrist, should live and be well, who came back that morning on Erev Simchat Torah with the 20 live hostages, the final 20 in the final deal. Daniel came back as the first of four bodies to return of the final 28. He came back in October 2025, and we did a second funeral. And I have to say to you, this, since then, it's actually been harder for me to go to Har Herzl, Mount Herzl. For the last year and a half before Simchat Torah, before Daniel's funeral, whenever I went to Mount Herzl, I thought I was more at a gravestone than at a grave. His body wasn't there. His body was somewhere in Gaza. By the way, we didn't actually know for a long time if it was held by Hamas. For the first year, we were told it was probably held by Islamic Jihad, which was even more challenging because you thought, even if you reach a deal with Hamas, you know, maybe it's only a couple of months before we were told that they can confirm that he was actually held by Hamas. You know, in what world are you happy, in inverted commas, that at least is with Hamas, where there's more of a chance? But I'll tell you that since the second funeral, on the one hand, there's so much relief that we don't have to bring his body back and his body is here. And thankfully that we're no longer stuck with him in Gaza and not knowing where he is. We can move forward, you know, with being a bereaved family and not having to bring his body back. But on some level, it's more difficult because now when I go to Mount Herzl, I feel that he's there. I can't hide from it. Before, when I would go there, like, I could sort of lose myself and, well, he's not really here. You know, as a believing person, his soul's in heaven and his body, God knows where it is. When I go now to Mount Herzl, I'm no longer going to an empty grave. He was, in fact, the only empty grave other than the uniform since October 7th until his body came back for burial. When I now go to Mount Herzl, I know that his body is there. He came back complete. And on some level, it's more difficult. I can't really hide from the fact that he's there. And for me, it's actually in some ways quite, you know, more painful.
I've heard you speak about Daniel in various different interviews and, of course, at the funerals. And in some ways, it sounds like he was, you know, a teenager like his counterparts in the United States or in South Africa. He liked wakeboarding. He liked running with his friends. He liked barbecuing. But on the other hand, you have this incredible example of heroism, of first of all, fighting with the army in order to be drafted into the tank unit. And then on October 7th, fighting for hours with his team against wave after wave of terrorists. And to hear Matan, just a few days out of captivity, come to the funeral and speak with such admiration about his commander was for me one of the deeply most moving parts of the last 2.5 years. What is it that turns, you know, sort of Israeli youth who are, again, like just sort of ordinary youth, like their counterparts? And I ask this also somebody who grew up in the United States, but then enables them to act with such heroism when they have to defend their country.
You know, it's a great question. You know, I think because of the needs of the state of Israel to defend ourselves and the need to have an active standing army, it's not a luxury. It's unfortunately we can't, as we know, we can't survive without a standing army, and as we all know, without a active reserve army. So there's something about teenagers who grow up very, very quickly when they have to face death in the eye and know that they have to defend their people. Daniel's a great example. Had Daniel been in South Africa or in America or another country, you know, he probably would have come for a gap year. He would have come back had he not stayed in Israel. He would have gone to college and university. And it really is many years, if you don't have to go and serve your country in the military, where maybe you don't have to think about what it means to put your life on the line. In Israel, necessity has created this reality that young people like Daniel and all of our children have to put their life on the line at a young age. And I have to say that in Daniel's case, being a ADHD, fun-loving, extreme sport, super sociable youngster, when he put on that uniform, in fact, before, when he decided not to take the low road, he could have gone because of his injury and become a job necker, you know, had done a job. He was very into investing money. He would often joke. Daniel was the stylish one in our family. He always chose, he liked the finer things in life. He would always laze with my wife when it came to style. I'm not the most stylish. My wife is more stylish. By the way, this is not usual for me in Israel to be wearing a tie, and this is how I dress on Shabbat. The only reason I'm dressed like this is I just came. I was the godfather. I was a sundek at a bris that a friend of mine who's had his fourth child, and both grandparents have already been the godfather, the sundek. So I literally just came from being the sundek at a brit milah. We're actually very privileged. There's already 12 children that we know of who've been named Daniel in honor of Daniel. This wasn't one of them. This, I was just a Sunday. So I literally came straight from the Brit Milah. So that's why I'm dressed like this. But Daniel would not liaise with me when it came to style and to fashion. He would liaise with my wife. And Daniel really liked the finer things in life. And he invested his money. He would often say to me, Daddy, I'm actually sitting in my library. He says, I've looked at all of your books. He said, your books are either books about Torah or about leadership. He said, I found 3 books on investing money and only one of them's good. And he said to me, he said, do you invest your money? I said, no, not really, Dan. He said, but why don't you? I said, you know, Dan, you know, I work for a nonprofit. I don't have so much money. We said, but he would say, but Daddy, that's why you should be investing your money. And he was very candid. He would say, Daddy, you know, for somebody who people think is very clever, you're actually not so clever. He would say that to me often. He said, because if you don't have so much money and you don't invest your money, like, where's the logic in that? Anyway, so Daniel used to invest his money. He would work very hard. He would work all types of jobs. And, you know, even though he was fun-loving, he also knew that he had a lifestyle to maintain. He would work and he would invest his money. So I was concerned that I thought Daniel, maybe since his injury, may take the low road, just have a day job and invest his money and take it easy. When he fought to go into the tank corps, even though he wanted to go into Sayeret Golani, but he couldn't because of his injury, that was really the first sign that this young man has actually made a decision that he really wants to use his God-given talents to serve the Jewish people and to be the best he can be. Then he went into the tank corps, and my wife and I joke, he grew a brain, meaning all of a sudden this kid was no longer about fun and about just friends, and it was about like something bigger than himself. He decided to go to Kurs Matakim, to commander's course. I'll never forget the day. He didn't tell us that he was selected to be the outstanding commander of the course. He didn't tell us that. So we went to Latrun, you know, the military, you know, the tank corps military sort of memorial. And they call out after all the awards, and the outstanding soldier of the course, Daniel Perez. And I remember saying to my wife, I said, I didn't know there were 2 Daniel Perez's in this course. It didn't cross my mind because he didn't tell us. Normally you tell your family. And then I remember when I seeing, and it was at that moment that I thought, wow, this kid has really matured. So the short answer to the question is there's something about the reality of an 18, 19-year-old. He also went to a pre-military academy for a year. So you go to the army a little bit later. there's something about a maturity that you're forced to confront your mortality. You're forced to confront something bigger than yourself. Everybody in Israel does it. It's not an elective. Yes, it's an elective whether you go to a combat unit or not. So I think we saw in front of our eyes in the 3 years from the age of 19 to 22, the 3.5 years that Daniel was in the army, we definitely saw a transformation. And I think it was that, and Daniel was very, very, very professional in what he did. I mean, if he did something, what's that about Daniel? If he didn't want to do something, you couldn't make him do it. If he wanted to do something, you couldn't stop him. Daniel went to the army. He was like a very sort of totally invested personality. He chose to go Adasof to the nth degree. And I think it's that sense of understanding that you're, you know, I think when he became a commander in the army, Asher, I think he had to really think about, you know, he's got soldiers he's commanding. Their life is in his hands. When I actually looked at his choveret, his the notebook of the commander, which came back from Nachal Oz, I learned a lot about him after his passing, where I read how seriously he took the role. I always knew how much he loved his soldiers and how well prepared they were. But I really saw a young man who took on the role of being a commander, and that soldiers are in his hands very seriously. And when he took that very, very critical and fateful decision to leave the safety of his tank position as the last line of defense and go straight towards the second wave of terrorists and knock over as many and put his head out the tank and shoot, that his whole, as Matan said, told us, they all followed him. They all had absolute faith in him. It was a tank which together made a decision that they need to do whatever they can to defend the Jewish people. So the short answer of this long answer is, I think the reality of living in Israel, where every young person who serves in the army has to face being part of something bigger than yourself and having to put your life on the line, I think forces you to mature very, very quickly and to really think what life is all about. And I think that's part of the challenge and the privilege of living in Israel.
Your comments make me think on like a broader national level, right? That we in Israel really rallied around the soldiers and the families of the hostages, again, especially in the beginning of the war. But things feel very back to normal in Israel these days. Again, especially now that we're in the ceasefire from the Iran war as well at this moment. And I guess as someone who has often has a message of unity, how do you think that the different camps in Israeli society can bring back that spirit, you know, that we're all in it together and move forward from the divisiveness and confrontation?
Yeah, look, I think our sages have taught us from the dawn of history that sinat chinam, baseless hatred, by the way, baseless is the scourge of everything from a moral, spiritual point of view. By the way, baseless hatred doesn't mean that you don't have a good reason in your own mind to dislike somebody, you know? I've never met somebody in my life who says, I hate somebody else for baseless reasons. I just hate them because I hate them. Everyone's got a good reason, but I'll say, just say, the reason to hate people is baseless, isn't that, is that we're on the same side over here. At the end of the day, all of us who prepared, Rahman al-Itzlan, God forbid, to die, to live in Israel, and to put our lives on the line for Israel. And Hamas on that day did not distinguish between any type of Jew and any type of Zionist. And when rockets fly into Israel, they don't distinguish between anyone. So our sages have always said to us that our major moral and spiritual challenge is how in our diversity do we remain intact with integrity of togetherness and family. And I think that is our biggest challenge. Unfortunately, we seem to be much better at being reminded that in times of a common enemy, when our common enemy wants to kill us, as Josephus has said, that even at the time of the destruction of the temple, he writes that Jews were still fighting amongst themselves who was to blame. Like the Romans didn't care. They said, listen, you can have the argument, you're both going to die, and you can have that argument in the afterlife, but right now it's not going to help you. So I think that this has always been the major scourge and the major challenge of Jewish destiny. Unfortunately, we feel the sense of unity more in times of challenge. I do think, love, that our biggest challenge has always been exactly this. How can we, knowing that we care so deeply about the future of Jewish destiny, knowing that we have such deep differences between us, how can we still prioritize the fact that we're in this together over the, what Freud has called the narcissism of small differences, that we make small differences into the biggest things that there are. Are our differences big? They are. And do we have real, genuine debates about everything? We do. But that should never take priority over the collective destiny of the Jewish people. And our enemies remind us that time and time again. They say, we don't actually care if you're left or right, or religious or irreligious, or how you define a Jew or Zionist, we don't care about it. And our only true enemies are those who wish to destroy us and those who support those who wish to destroy us. I say political enemies are not enemies. They're not adversaries. Yes, they're political opponents. And yes, we need to fight and battle for the ideology that we believe in. But when you're battling with your own brothers and sisters, it cannot be an ideological zero-sum game. I say that in my mind, the ideological paradigm, in my opinion, has to be this. And I actually said this at Daniel's second funeral. It's a line that I said, I write a lot about, I believe in to the depth of my being. I said at Daniel's second funeral, I ended by saying that the Jewish people may be the smallest people in the world, but we are the biggest family. And I think in that line is the essence of the Jewish people. Before we received the Torah and we became a religious community, we were a people, we came out of Egypt. And before we were a people, we were a family. The book of Bereshit is about a family, a man and a woman called Avraham and Sarah, and also a human family before of Noah and his wife and Adam and Eve before. But the Jewish story, when we honed in on the Jewish people, we don't begin with, the Torah doesn't begin with the person who revealed the Torah. It begins with founding fathers and mothers, and not founding fathers and mothers like George Washington, a founding father, is the founding father of a nation. It begins with a founding father. I don't know what George Washington's wife's name was, but I know that Abraham Avinu's wife was Sarah. She's our founding mother. And I know that they were the founding fathers of a nation because they were the founding fathers and mothers of a family. They had a child called Isaac, and Isaac married Rebecca, and they had a child called Jacob who struggled. And being part of a family is the essence of Jewish peoplehood and the Jewish religion. And that doesn't mean we don't fight like a family. Oh yes, the book of Bereshit is full of fighting as a family, but the book of Bereshit, the book of Genesis, admonishes us that when brothers give up on each other, when Joseph was given up on by Judah and their brother, and they were prepared to sell him for whatever the reason, our sages tell us that the sin of the sale of Joseph, 10 brothers, excluding Benjamin, who wasn't yet born, sold Joseph. And those 10 brothers, our sages say, are the 10 martyrs who keep recurring in Jewish history, that we keep suffering the 10 martyrs. Why? When brothers give up and sisters give up on each other, something is wrong. Does that mean we don't have arguments? Of course we have arguments. Does it mean that we don't see the destiny of the family differently? We do, and we should. But we have to understand is that we, at the end of the day, we're in this together. And if we can't find a solution together, it doesn't matter. I often say, I said at Daniel's funeral, I said, there's often a discussion about what the day after in Gaza is going to look like. I said, it's more important what the day after in Israel looks like. If we get our act together in Israel, we'll work out what the day after in Gaza will look like. So we really have to get our act together. And that, I believe, is the challenge of Jewish destiny and Jewish leadership.
Now, I want to ask you one more quick question before we go. We're talking at a time that there's a bit of a public debate going on. I don't know if you saw this over the weekend. There was a newspaper column in Makor Rishon, which is the religious Zionist biggest newspaper, I guess, where one of the prominent columnists called American Jews traitors for not moving to Israel. And then the editor of the Jerusalem Post, who was born in the U.S. but grew up in Israel, has lived in Israel almost his whole life, talked about how, no, actually, people have very good reasons for continuing to live in the diaspora. And I feel like there's been a lot of, it's on social media, but a lot of sort of discourse about these sort of topics, and as someone who like Asher and myself has lived both abroad and in Israel for large portions of our lives, I guess, where do you stand on this debate, and what would your message be to people?
So I want to say like this, the reason I was actually a little bit late for this podcast is I was just completing my response to the editor of Makor Rishon magazine, which is going to appear in the Makor Rishon magazine. So I wrote a response to him, and I basically said this, and I'll share it with you. I said, no love for the land of Israel, the state of Israel, or love for the Torah of Israel should triumph and trump over the love of the Jewish people. We love all people. We have a particular love for the Jewish people, for the shared history that we have and being part of this people, which has always believed it was singled out to be able to be a source of blessing to the world. And we want people. We want people. And calling fellow Jews traitors, the only time I believe you can even enter that discussion is if fellow Jews are marching together with Hamas and saying the Jewish state should be destroyed and the Jewish people in Israel should fold, then you can begin a discussion. And fortunately, they are on the Notary Carta on the one side and on the and the radical left on the other. Thankfully, a very small minority of people. But there are Jews today who really support Hamas and feel more for Hamas and the children of Hamas operatives than they do for their own people in Israel. To me, that is questionable to what extent people still feel part of the Jewish people. But any Jew who feels the pain of the Jewish people, no matter what their views are, and any Jew who throws their lot in with the Jewish people, how can these people be called traitors? How can they be called traitors? Are we repeating the sin of Joseph, where Joseph and Judah, the sail of Joseph, cared for each other, yet brothers can give up on each other? So I stand unequivocally, the Jewish people are one people. And every Jew who wants the good of the Jewish people, it supports Jewish destiny, does not march and support the enemies of the Jewish people who wish to destroy us, are fully part of the Jewish people. It's well above 95% of all Jews. It's in the Pew reports in America, over, I think it's about 93% of Jews believe, support the right of the Jewish people to have a state somewhere in the land of Israel. And if you look at it in its entirety, it's probably over 95% of world Jewry, including Israel. So are there a few percent on the extremes which side with our enemies and are confused? They are, but the vast majority of Jews are not that. And to call Jews who have not made Aliyah, who are fighting for the future of Judaism and the Jewish people on campuses and have sent billions of dollars in the war, and many of their children live in Israel, and the solidarity that they feel with Israel, to even to say that, I think is what I said in my article is, I think the author's love for the land and state of Israel have perhaps blinded him a little bit to the love of every Jew. And we have to balance, we have to balance our loves and loyalties, and we should never let ideology and our perceptive of what we think is right come in place of our feeling of solidarity with people which are part of our family and our people.
Rabbi Doron, thank you so much for joining us. This is really a moving and important conversation, and obviously we'll be thinking of Daniel tonight and tomorrow. And we'll be celebrating together with all of Am Yisrael and the people of Israel, on Yom Ha'atzmaut. So thank you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Asha. Thank you, Lav. And to all of the listeners, thank you. All the best.
Thank you for listening. Make sure to subscribe, like, and follow Misgav at www.misgavins.org and on social media. Send your comments, questions, and suggestions to MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. And we will be back next week.